They are elected by you, I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Article 1 initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federalist Society.
Recently, we were saddened to hear of the passing of Senator Orrin Hatch. In his honor, we hope you will enjoy revisiting the following remarks Senator Hatch gave during the 2015 Federalist Society National Lawyers Convention on the separation of powers and the role of Congress. The senator was introduced by Leonard Leo, then Executive Vice President of the Federalist Society.
It's a privilege for me this afternoon to introduce our next speaker, U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch. My first experience with the senator dates back to 1985, when I was serving as a clerk on the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on the Constitution. It was an exciting time with a number of very consequential issues squarely before the Senate, from immigration to new civil rights legislation to a raging battle over the extent to which Senate Democrats should attack and block President Reagan's judicial nominees. What I remember most about my brief tenure there is how Senator Hatch demonstrated such great wisdom about the thrust and parry of the legislative process and the long-term dangers of abusing it. One afternoon, he predicted that the kind of behavior we were witnessing toward judicial nominees would set in motion a fundamental change in the way confirmations would proceed, requiring Republican presidential nominees to rebuff certain policy and jurisprudential litmus tests. And of course, he was right. Things have never been the same since those days. I learned also that Senator Hatch was a master of procedure. The legislative filibusters he orchestrated back then were thoughtful and strategic and evidenced a keen understanding of the importance of making sure that significant public policy proposals receive thorough deliberation. It's striking today that some actually wish to do away with the legislative filibuster, and with it, the important checks and balances it enshrines to prevent cram-down legislation. Finally, Senator Hatch took seriously his duty to understand what the Constitution required of him as a legislator. A day did not go by without Senator Hatch relating a particular legislative proposal to issues of federalism, the separation of powers, or the core freedoms set forth in the Bill of Rights. Few Senate hearings these days match the intellectual rigor of what took place back then, at least in my recollection, when Senator Hatch presided over the Senate Subcommittee on the Constitution and aided Senator Strom Thurmond in guiding the hearings of the full Judiciary Committee. We are all indebted to you, Senator Hatch, for the occasions you fought to shape legislative power in ways that comported with the vision of the Founding Fathers, and for the many instances where you have sought to secure a judiciary that is true to the Constitution as it's written. Your irrepressible defense of William Rehnquist and Robert Bork, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, many Court of Appeals nominees during their divisive confirmation battles was masterful and unparalleled. And so, Senator, it's a great privilege for me to once again welcome you to the Federalist Society.
Well, thank you, Leonard. You were a great person to work with back in those days, and we were in the middle of an awful lot of very important battles, and they were tough, mean-spirited battles as well. Well, thank you, and it's always a real pleasure to address this. An active member and supporter of the Federalist Society from the beginning, and I still believe as strongly as ever in the principles that you're all seeking to advance. At this annual gathering, it's always worthwhile to set aside a few moments to reflect upon these principles and to clarify exactly what our priorities really are. Every year, this is a spectacular meeting. I'm especially amazed by our numbers last night and yesterday and today. The last time I saw so many lawyers in one place, there was an ambulance nearby. I promise to avoid legal humor today if I can. It's hard in this profession, I'll tell you. My wife actually says I confirm the stereotype that lawyers aren't funny. That's understandable. Litigation is not humorous to most people. It's just plain expensive. By the way, Brent, who is your treasurer and who's worked as a Federal Society leader from the beginning, my son, just won a huge victory last night out there in Utah, a multi-million-dollar victory. He's carrying the torch for the Federalist Society. And he was so pleased to call me and tell me about it. The mainstream media, of course, is not always helpful in eliminating the goals of the society. At this annual event, we are often treated like clockwork to media accounts that breathlessly cast the Federalist Society as an embodiment of some supposed vast right-wing conspiracy. And despite the lift, this organization isn't some cabal plotting to push a particular political agenda. We leave that work to the Illuminati. And I'm not sure where they hold their annual meetings, but I hear the food is incredible. Okay, this organization has always held itself to the highest of standards in refusing to embrace any particular political agenda. Instead, it is a forum for vibrant debate among our diverse membership made up of conservatives, libertarians, and moderates, and plenty of liberals, by the way, are included to ensure that as many points of view as possible are well represented. And we're proud of that. The Society also stands for just three principles that state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of powers is fundamental to our system of Republican self-government, and that it is emphatically the province and the duty of the judiciary to say what the law is and not what the law should be. Some may suggest that this approach is simply an astute means of coalition building, and then by abstracting its principles, the society is able to build a larger, more ideologically diverse membership. Now, there's no doubt that the Federalist Society has built an impressive record over the many years as a proverbial big tent that would make the fusionist fathers of the new right, like William F. Buckley and Frank Meyer, very proud. Nevertheless, there is a much deeper lesson manifest in the society's principles than simple pragmatic politics, namely that our first loyalty is to the Constitution rather than to any ideology or political party. We are constitutionalists first and conservatives second. And I say constitutionalists first, conservatives and misguided liberals second. The framers designed our system of government with an eye toward one principle above all others, that in the words of Madison in Federalist 47, the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, whether in one, few, or many, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. And from this principle, the framers derived the central feature of our constitutional structure, the diffusion of government powers among the three branches, legislative, executive, and judicial. And moreover, within the legislative branch, the framers further divided power between the House of Representatives and the United States Senate. The division of legislative power, the power that the framers thought would necessarily predominate in a republic such as ours, between the two houses, bestowed upon us a far greater legacy than just a workable compromise at the Constitutional Convention between the large states and the small states. It also gave our republic two legislative bodies very different in character and function. The House of Representatives is an organ of government designed to embody the will of the people. Its smaller constituencies and shorter terms encourage members to stay in close touch with voters. With 435 members, robust participation by every member in every debate is impossibly cumbersome. The House is defined by majority rule, as logically benefits a body that embodies the popular will. By contrast, the framers designed the Senate to serve as what they called a necessary fence against the fickleness and passion that sometimes drives popular pressure for hasty or ill-considered lawmaking, or as Edmund Randolph once said, the turbulence and follies of democracy. Similarly, James Madison described the Senate's purpose as twofold. First, to protect the people against their rulers, and secondly, to protect the people against the transient impressions into which they themselves might be led. In accomplishing these goals, the Senate not only checks transient and occasionally intemperate impulses, but also refines the popular will through wisdom and sound judgment. Perhaps the most important characteristic that aids these important functions is the Senate's relatively small size, which enables each senator to contribute more meaningfully to the debate. The primacy of individual senators' rights has long guided the development of the Senate's rules and traditions, including the right to extend a debate, an open amendment process, and a committee system that gives members from the most seasoned chairman to the newest freshman a hand in writing and improving legislation. Moreover, in order to function efficiently or effectively, the Senate frequently requires members to agree to temporary modifications to the institution's oft-times complex and cumbersome rules, agreements that require the unanimous consent of all senators. These rules give each senator a stake in the legislative process and enable each to bring his or her considered judgment to bear on pressing national issues. In exercising this considered judgment, senators must temper their pursuit of the common good with prudence. Aristotle called prudence the legislative science because it concerns the best means of achieving the greatest good in practice. Prudence restrains us from seeking immediate and complete vindication of a single abstract principle. Instead, it counsels us to work within our existing circumstances to vindicate the enduring principles upon which liberty depends. We cannot simply charge forward blind to present realities. To do so is to jeopardize hope for achieving any meaningful success in this messy world of politics. Adopting an all-or-nothing strategy, which some are doing lately, usually produces only the latter, nothing. Prudence is particularly crucial because the expansive rights of individual senators are a double-edged sword. At once, both the great genius of the institution and the source of potential pitfalls. By giving a minority of senators, sometimes even a minority of one, great influence over the business of the whole body, the Senate endows individual members with enormous power. Senators may refuse to end debate, place holds on bills, on nominees, as we're all too familiar with, and object to unanimous consent requests, effectively grinding the institution to a halt. Accordingly, the majority leadership entrusted with managing the Senate's business must shape the chamber's business in a manner that respects minority rights if the Senate is to function effectively. In the minds of many of our federal citizens, however, the Senate's rules are not being employed in the interests of thoughtful legislation or productive oversight, but rather for mindless partisanship and political grandstanding. To many, Senate procedure has become a synonym for mindless obstruction. To a certain extent, they're right. While the whole republic has benefited time and again from the Senate's rules when they have been employed wisely and judiciously, the manipulation of these timeless rules over the past few years to serve a transient partisan agenda has caused serious dysfunction. The Senate's work has increasingly been defined by repeated and escalating instances of abuse that threatens the Senate's ability to serve the American people. The single strongest driving force behind this institutional damage has been the current leadership of the minority party. During their time in the majority over the previous 8 years, Democratic leaders inflicted serious damage to many of the Senate's defining features. Consider the right to extended debate. The Democratic leadership in the last Congress frequently moved to end debate on a measure at the very same time the message was brought to the floor or brought up for consideration, employing this tactic far more than in previous Congresses. The result of this tactic was not to end the debate on legislation, but rather to prevent it altogether. And whenever those of us in the then minority resisted the demand that we end debate as soon as we begin consideration of the bill, the Democrat leadership wrongly labeled our resistance a filibuster. Worst of all, when the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals tried to hold the Obama administration accountable to the law and the Constitution, the Democrats sought, in their own words, to, quote, switch the majority, unquote, on the court, and to, quote, fill up the D.C. Circuit one way or another, unquote, in order to pack this crucial court, and I mean it is crucial. Some think it may be every bit the equal of the Supreme Court because it hears countless issues that the court will never have time to take up, and on very, very important governmental things. But in order to pack this crucial court, they invoked spurious claims of obstruction to take the drastic step of abolishing extended debate altogether on most nominations using the so-called nuclear option. Next, consider amendments. Instead of allowing an open amendment process, the Democratic leadership used a procedural maneuver known as filling up the tree right after filing the bill to deny senators the right to offer amendments. By refusing to allow amendment votes, the Democratic leadership invited minority opposition to the underlying measures, killing important bipartisan legislation like the Energy Efficiency Bill and the Sportsman Bill, just to mention a few. In fact, in the last Congress, almost a year went by during which the Democratic majority allowed votes on only 11 amendments from the Republican minority. During that period, all 45 senators in the minority together got fewer votes on amendments than one House Democrat, Congressman Sheila Jackson Lee. According to the Congressional Research Service, the previous majority leader used his position to block the consideration of amendments more than twice as much as the previous six majority leaders combined. Finally, consider committee work. In the last Congress, many bills that received floor consideration bypassed the committee process altogether. They would take a ride into the leader's office and they would decide what the bill should be. The Finance Committee was a particularly abused committee in that regard. And the reason was, well, maybe I better not say the reason. That would be maybe too frank. In fact, each of the past four Congresses set a new record for, and by the way, it wasn't because of Republicans that they did that, it was because of Democrats. And in each of the past four Congresses, they set a record for the number of bills brought directly to the Senate floor. The unfortunate but predictable result of this tactic was to waste the Senate's valuable floor time on partisan messaging bills that no one seriously expected to become law. Now, both sides do that from time to time, but this was done to excess. Now, in the minority, the Democratic leadership initially promised to cooperate with the new Republican majority. Unfortunately, they soon returned to abusing Senate rules, this time from the minority position. They have refused to allow the Senate even to begin consideration of bills by filibustering so-called motions to proceed. Now, this maneuver prevents the Senate from engaging in substantive floor debate and from considering amendments to reshape legislation. Forget getting across the finish line. Senate Democrats won't even allow us to line up on at the starting gate to even begin the process of addressing their concerns. There's no way to get a bill from 54 votes to 60 votes if the other side won't even engage in the first place. And while Republicans occasionally used the same tactic in the last Congress, we resorted to it only when the Democratic leadership expressly refused to allow votes on Republican amendments that the Democratic leadership didn't like. Democrats have also abused Senate rules by refusing to return to regular order on spending bills. Ever since 2011, we lived through crisis after crisis over fiscal cliffs and expiring funding. This has been something of a boondoggle for Democrats. By waiting until the last possible moment to reach agreement, with the threat of a shutdown staring us in the face, Congress has been unable to make the sort of lasting budgetary reforms our country needs. And there is little room or appetite to reform particular programs or reduce funding levels when a massive deadline looms and the consequences of missing the deadline may well be catastrophic. Unsurprisingly, the Democrats have exploited this dynamic, seizing on high-level disagreements on spending levels. For months, they blocked consideration of individual spending bills, in other words, appropriation bills. This is the first time all 12 appropriation bills were brought to the floor. But they filibustered every attempt Republicans made to bring a spending bill to the floor until just recently on one that they just couldn't. This is not responsible governance. Rather, it's a way to maintain the status quo in terms of spending and government programs. By locking arms and refusing even to consider spending bills outside of massive last-minute measures, Democrats have prevented Congress from addressing our debt problem, our spending problem, and our entitlement crisis. Sadly, the upper chamber is still reeling from the previous majority leader's abuses. If I ever send him another bill, it'll be a bill to pay for all the damage he's done to the Senate. Now, he's a friend, but he knows that I feel this way, because I've said it on the floor so many times. My only concern, and to him personally, my only concern is that he'd raise taxes to pay for it. You know, I'm joking, but let me make one thing clear. While I respect the previous majority leader as a colleague, I do not respect the tactics he used to advance his radical agenda. And he didn't even advance that very well. The result has been protracted gridlock. Into the breach begotten by this gridlock has stepped President Obama. While the president never, and I mean never, demonstrated any serious commitment to bipartisan legislating when he was in the Senate, he has now declared that he, quote, won't take no for an answer, unquote, when Congress refuses to go along with his far-left agenda, and that, quote, when Congress won't act, I will, unquote. He has followed up these threats with a variety of unilateral executive actions, many of which are flatly inconsistent with the law and the Constitution. And they're suddenly coming to the forefront because the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, among others, is starting to rebel a little bit and say, hey, wait a minute, there is a Constitution, you know. This brazen lawlessness has come in many different forms regarding, well, let me just mention a few, regulating contrary to the plain text of the law, such as with the Clean Power Plan, using conditioned waivers as a means of effectively rewriting entire statutes without Congress, such as with Department of Education's handling of No Child Left Behind, creating gaping enforcement carve-outs, thereby effectively gutting duly passed legislation, such as with deferred action on illegal immigration, ignoring his statutory obligations without meaningful justification, such as with the Taliban Five from Guantanamo, and convincing Congress to pass legislation that removes checks on presidential power, such as with Dodd-Frank's removal of congressional control over spending, authority, and undermining effective judicial review. These are just a few examples, but the point is clear. Time and again, President Obama has flouted his constitutional authority and encroached on the legislative authority of a gridlocked Congress. In order to restore Congress to its proper role in the system of separated power, there is much work to be done. First, we must restore a sense of mutual restraint in the legislative branch. From various quarters, including from within the Senate itself, we hear calls to eliminate the rights of the Senate minority. Though these calls may be instinctively appealing, we should consider them with caution. Without these minority rights, the Senate would lose its unique character and would instead merely duplicate the work of the House of Representatives, adding a layer of gridlock to the legislative process for no really good reason. Those who call on the Senate to sharply curtail the rights of the minority should keep in mind that this is not the first Congress to face dysfunction. In particular, we should recall the example of Mike Mansfield, the late senator from Montana, a man I got to know. Senator Mansfield served as majority leader from 1961 until 1977, longer than any other senator in history. Those were turbulent times for the nation and the Senate alike, when the issues of the day could hardly have been more divisive. Near the beginning of his tenure, when a determined Senate minority stymied President Kennedy's legislative priorities, Senator Mansfield faced great pressure from within his own party to exert the majority's power more assertively. Senator Mansfield, however, resisted the call of his colleagues to bend the Senate rules. Though tempted by the prospect of important political victories, he instead counseled that the remedy to gridlock, quote, lies not in the seeking of shortcuts, not in the cracking of non-existent whips, and not in wheeling and dealing, but by accommodation, by respect for one another, and by mutual restraint, unquote. Now, Senator Mansfield was right, and his wisdom is perhaps more relevant now than ever. For the Senate to function effectively, senators of all stripes must practice mutual restraint, Republican and Democrat, conservative and liberal, majority and minority alike. In practice, restraint requires different sacrifices of different senators, depending on their position in the body. For the majority leadership, mutual restraint is measured in part by what sort of measures leadership brings before the Senate for consideration. Do the measures tend to be divisive, partisan messaging bills that have no chance of passing, or do they intend to be measures that can gather at least some bipartisan support, measures that may offer less prospect of a partisan victory, but greater prospect of actually becoming law? Restraint is also measured by how the majority leadership guides the Senate's consideration of a particular measure. Is there an open amendment process that allows all senators to contribute to the chamber's work and that seeks means of mutual accommodation? Or does the majority leader consistently fill the amendment tree, freezing legislation in the exact form that only he demands? Is the full Senate given sufficient time to freely and thoroughly debate a measure? Or does the majority leader move to end debate as soon as it begins? The need for mutual restraint also creates correlative obligations for the minority, be it an entire party or a single senator. From filibusters to poison pill amendments, to objections, to routine unanimous consent requests, an often underappreciated but incredibly important tool to chew up valuable time, senators in the minority have numerous ways they can grind the Senate to a halt. Senators on both sides of the aisle, myself included, have relied on these means before. Their use can be quite legitimate when employed judiciously and when motivated by serious policy disagreement. However, when employed indiscriminately for the purpose of frustrating the operation of the Senate for personal or partisan gain, the use of such tactics is, in my opinion, deeply improper. The appropriateness of the minority's behavior hinges in large part on the actions of the majority. With the power to decide the Senate's business, including what the Senate considers as well as how it considers it, the majority's behavior rightfully shapes the minority's response. Majority restraint invites minority restraint, beginning productive legislating, whereas majority overreach invites minority intransigence, causing only dysfunction. Under the new Republican majority, we have made significant progress in restoring the Senate to proper functioning, passing dozens of bipartisan center-right bills and holding roll call votes on 168 different amendments. It was almost 160 by the time we did the August recess. In fact, earlier this year, we voted on more amendments in 1 week than we did in all of last year. And about half of those amendments are Democrat amendments, some of which have chilled my blood a little bit from time to time. And throughout this Congress, Senate Republicans have tried to de-escalate the partisan arms race to abuse the Senate rules. While our efforts have not met with unbridled cooperation from the Democratic minority, we have made significant progress. On the Finance Committee alone, we've passed over 40 bipartisan bills since the first of the year. And it's been a pleasure. I've had Democrats come up to me and say, isn't it wonderful that we now get to vote on things? You know, after only 11 votes, or 16 votes, I think it was, in the whole prior year. And I agreed with him. It's really quite wonderful. While our efforts have not met with unbridled cooperation from the Democrat minority, we have made significant progress. Based on this experience, members of both parties have begun discussing the possibility of some rules changes that could gain bipartisan support. Reforms that would improve the effectiveness of the Senate while preserving critical minority rights. And while many of us are still evaluating some of these proposals, a few narrowly tailored changes to the Senate's rules that can win broad support may be the order. And they're going to have to win broad support to change the rules. Two-thirds vote. Second, we need to recognize that in order to get anything done in this town, we have to work together. And unless your party holds the White House and the House majority and 60 votes in the Senate, that means working together with the other party. Now, this doesn't mean that you sacrifice your principles. No deal was worth casting aside your convictions. But it does mean that you work to find areas of common agreement. Neither side gets everything at once, and that's okay. The framers intentionally designed our constitutional system to require consensus among multiple competing factions. Ours, of course, is not a parliamentary system. The party in control of the lower house cannot ram through whatever it wants by a bare party line vote. Rather, the party in control of the lower house must work with the party in control of the upper house and the party and the person in the White House to find policies that all three can agree on. Now, this is a slow process with many roadblocks and many veto gates. It would behoove us, I think, to bear all of this in mind. In short, we need to restore the culture of cooperation in Congress. Reaching across party lines to find areas of agreement needs to be seen not as an act of treason, but as an act of political reality and good governance, if you will. Those who proclaim fidelity to the Constitution should recognize, indeed, they must recognize, that the Constitution requires the parties and the branches to work together. To advocate a go-it-alone or my way or the highway approach is not merely to blink political reality. It is to pretend the Constitution does not exist. Moreover, renewing our willingness to work together would actually help strengthen Congress as an institution. When Congress is dysfunctional, when it can't get anything done, the result is a power vacuum. And that vacuum gets filled by the president and executive branch agencies. At this point, I promise I'm reaching the end of my remarks, but I don't want to keep anyone here too long. After all, these are billable hours of yours that I'm using, and I doubt many firms have a billing code for listening to my talk. So hang in there, everyone. If my charisma can't keep you awake, then maybe my sex appeal can. Of course, I'm talking to the women in the audience. I better be careful here. Finally, Congress must stop enabling executive overreach through irresponsible legislation. The unfortunate truth is that many of President Obama's abuses are rooted in irresponsible, unwise, short-sighted, or counterproductive laws that Congress has passed. Sometimes Congress has enabled executive overreach by shielding agencies from accountability. Consider, for example, how Congress acceded to the Obama administration's demands in crafting the Dodd-Frank banking, quote, reform, unquote, law. And I did put that in quotes for very good reasons. At the president's urging, Congress created a new agency called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, with complete freedom from congressional oversight, absolute authority to set its own budget, and near immunity from judicial review. By agreeing to these changes, Congress eliminated its ability to check this new agency in any meaningful way. We see the problem of agency unaccountability at work on a broader scale in the deficiencies of the Administrative Procedures Act. This 70-year-old law needs to be revised to require serious transparency by agencies. Needs cost-benefit analysis and evidence-based rulemaking, meaningful judicial review and a mechanism for retrospective review of existing regulations. At other times, Congress has passed laws that are overly vague or that fail to get at the problem they seek to address. Too often, the urge to do something overwhelms the prudence to do something well. Consider, for example, the EPA's costly rules regulating carbon dioxide. Although Congress plainly did not intend to authorize EPA to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, the Clean Air Act's operative language is so vague that it has facilitated motivated misinterpretation. Overbroad delegation has thus enabled a vast overreach by the President that Congress really never meant to authorize. Congress's tendency to pass vague or imprecise laws has manifested itself most problematically in the area of criminal law. Too often, when something bad happens, the immediate response has been to seek to criminalize that bad thing. But not every bad act needs to be criminalized. In many cases, civil penalties suffice. Moreover, the fact that something bad happens does not necessarily mean there is a hole somewhere in the criminal code that must be plugged. In most cases, existing law provides all the tools prosecutors need to bring bad actors to justice. And in those cases where new criminal penalties are warranted, Congress must take care to define with precision both the scope of the proscribed conduct and the elements that the government must prove in order to convict. Otherwise, we will see innocent Americans ensnared in the criminal justice system because Congress swept too broadly or gave officials too much discretion in deciding which cases to bring. I'm particularly troubled by the absence of clear mens rea requirements in much of our criminal law. The requirement that the government prove the defendant acted with a guilty mind is one of the great bulwarks against unjust prosecution and incarceration of morally innocent actors. Far too often, however, Congress has passed criminal laws that lack mens rea requirements or that authorize agencies to create crimes with such requirements. For this reason, I've written legislation to set a default mens rea requirement for all criminal statutes and regulations that lack such a requirement. My bill would not mandate a particular mens rea standard for all crimes, nor would it override existing standards set forth in statutes. All it would do is set a default for when Congress has failed to specify the criminal intent required for conviction. That's important to me. It should be important to all of you, too. I have the legislation ready to go. Indeed, contrary to some reports, I've had the language ready for months, and I shared it with multiple Democratic offices long before the Senate sentencing bill was ever introduced. I'm hopeful that my default mens rea bill can be introduced in the near future, and that we can move forward soon on this most important issue. I might also add that there's no doubt in my mind that some people have been sent to jail who could have been better treated and better helped in other ways. And we need to find those people and give them a break. On the other hand, we had to be careful. We have to be very, very careful. I was one of those who put in place the rules that really have resulted in a tremendous reduction in crime in this country, the mandatory minimum rules, which I think have gone too far. On the other hand, we've got to be very, very careful if we're going to change those rules, because they did, and the evidence is that crime was brought down dramatically during these intervening years. In closing, I should note that responsible legislating is not an easy task. It requires difficult compromises, political risks, and a lot of hard work. Nevertheless, the consequences of inaction, namely overreach by the executive branch, create an absolute imperative for Congress to act and act responsibly. Congress must reclaim its rightful role as the primary lawmaking body in our constitutional system, and once again serve as a crucial check against executive encroachment if the abuses of recent years are to be reversed and not duplicated by the other party when they have the opportunity. I'm grateful for all of you and for your support of the Federalist Society. This is a grand society. And like I say, it's not particularly made for just anybody. We all have benefited from the work of these folks who run this society. We've all benefited by the debates that have occurred. We've all benefited by the many, many really well thought out remarks that have been made over the years. And we've all benefited by being together and getting better acquainted, tapping each other's sources of wisdom, and of course, by just being friends. And what's great about it is that we come from all segments of the philosophical component. And I'm proud of all of you for doing so, and I just want to say that as bad as I've painted the Congress today, it's actually worse. But it's actually better, too. I have to say that we're making some headway. We're actually doing some things that are bringing both sides together more often. And we still have those who feel very deeply about upsetting the so-called apple cart. I'm one of those myself, and I've done it over the years on things that I really feel very deeply about. And we've won some pretty darn important battles over the years because of the filibuster rule. I just want you to know it can be abused. It has been abused. And we've got to make sure that our leaders allow the Senate to function. If it will function, it really is and will be the greatest deliberative body in the world. And it will be a great component with this wonderful public body called the House of Representatives. God bless you all. Thanks so much.
We have time for one or two questions, and then we're going to break for the next session. So, Senator.
I have to shout it out because I can't see very well. Yes.
Thank you very much, Senator. I'm one of those that does not think the filibuster does more good than harm. I think it does more harm than good. The reason I think that is because historically, liberals and those who want to grow government are very ideologically united. When liberals are in power, when they control the Senate, and they want to expand the government, they're always successful in peeling off four or five Republicans to join them. When Republicans are in power, the Democrats stay ideologically united. There are never 60 votes to significantly roll back the size or scope of the government, as evidenced by the fact that in modern times, never once have we significantly rolled back the size and scope of government. And we have a presidential campaign going on right now, and multiple candidates are pledging to eliminate multiple departments of the government. But there will not be 60 votes for that. The Democratic Party will never allow a bill getting rid of the Department of Commerce or the Department of Education to withstand the filibuster, to get past the filibuster. So.
Where do I stand?
Yeah. I mean, what evidence is there that the filibuster does more good than harm?
Well, I can tell you dozens of bills that would have wrecked this country overnight had we not had the filibuster rule. Let me just go back to a young freshman senator in 1977 and 78 who the whole business community came to me. Now, the only reason they came to me, I was 98th in seniority. I was all that was left. Nobody else was willing to take this on. Labor law reform had gone through the House like a dose of salt's not a bad analogy, by the way. And they had nowhere else to turn. So in my little tiny Dirksen office, everybody who was anybody in the business community in this town, head of the chamber, head of the NFIB, head of the business roundtable, et cetera, and the hoteliers, retailers, et cetera, they met with me in this little tiny office. And here's what they said. They said, we know we can't win, but we have to fight this. Would you be willing to lead a filibuster? And I said, well, in my bushy-tailed freshman senator sort of way, I said, well, I think you can win. And they looked at me like, where did this kid come from? What a dumbbell. And I said, yeah, I'll lead the fight if you'll do two things. And they said, what are those? I said, number one, if I ask you to do something, I don't care what it costs, you do it. I said, I'm not going to ask you to do something that's not essential or not important. But if I ask you to do it, you do it. They coughed and sputtered and finally said, okay, we'll do that. What else? I said, nobody breaks ranks. And at that point, there was a look of panic because they'd never been able to keep the unionized companies with them. And at that time, unions were like 30-35% of the workforce. Now, labor law reform went through the House, and bam. There were, at the time, 62 Democrats, 38 Republicans. And some of the Republicans, there were 14 liberal Republicans led by Jacob Javits of New York. I mean, it didn't look like you could win. And in the end, after six historic cloture votes, they were going to give us two of them because they didn't want to brutalize Dick Lugar and me, ask him to help freshman senators too badly. So they let us have the first two, but then they were surprised we had three, and then four, and then five, and then finally, the most substantive votes on a filibuster in the Senate's history, the sixth one. And we all knew that was the vote that was going to make the break. And I was going to lose. In fact, I remember I had to hold on to Ed Zirinsky, who was from Nebraska. But they didn't realize that Zirinsky was a close friend of mine. And that morning, I called him. I said, "Are you with me, Ed?" He said, "Well, they beat me up in Bob Byrd's office for 3 hours last night." I said, "Well, I got to have you." He said, "Well, mark me down as a tremulous no." He said he was very shaken by it. I said, "Well, I got to know." I said, "Let me know when you come on the floor." And Howard Baker came in. We were using his inner office. He came in. He said, "You know you're going to lose, Warren." I said, "Yeah, I know I'm going to lose." The Chamber of Commerce president said, "You're going to lose." I said, "Yeah, I know I'm going to lose." He said, "What do you want to do?" He said, "They're willing to give you a little of a procedural ploy that'll make it look like you won something." I said, "Howard," I said, "I'd rather have everybody in this country know who did it to them." And he turned white because he'd been working with Russell Long, and they knew they were going to win in the end. And Howard was dealing with the unions. He wanted to run for president, and I think there was maybe a little promise by the unions on this thing. Well, but he stuck with me. He promised he would. He did. He was a marvelous man, and I loved him dearly. So we go out on the floor, and the only Democrat who spoke out against labor law reform in the whole solid month on the floor was Fritz Hollings. And Hollings came up to me. I never could understand him. He spoke a different English than I did. He came up on the floor, and he said, "Owen, you know you're going to lose." And I said, "Yeah, I know." He said, "Well, Bert's going to do this motion. That sounds good," he said, "but you're going to have to object." I said, "I'm not objecting." He said, "You're not going to object?" He said, "Who's going to object?" I said, "You are." And he went, "Me?" And I said, "Yeah, you." He said, "Well, what about Zirinsky?" I said, "You let me handle Zirinsky." So Zirinsky came walking in 2 minutes before the vote. He sat down on the far left of the dais, of the chamber. And I went like that to him, and he went like that back. And I went to Fritz and I said, "I've got Zirinsky." He said, "Well, then I'm going to object," he said. So I hope I'm not boring you with this story. It's a little long, maybe I shouldn't have told it. But
It's good.
I can't help myself. But it's just a perfect illustration of how important a filibuster is. And because had we lost that, we'd have gone straight to socialism. There's no doubt in my mind at all. So Byrd gets up and makes this very, now I happen to gain a great appreciation for R.C. Byrd. Before he died, he would never, ever have allowed to go on what went on in the last seven or eight years. He would never have allowed the president to do what he's doing on executive orders. He would never have allowed the president to ignore legislation and ignore the Congress and to usurp the powers of the legislative body. He would never have allowed that to happen. He would have raised unholy hell. But he got up and he started making this very flowery motion to recommit the bill back to the Senate Labor Committee with a report back forthwith as a pending business. Now, there was good reason for that. We'd worked all night long to have 1,000 amendments to this post-cloture, and that was before you could end in 30 hours in post-cloture. That's what caused the rule to change, because we would have kept them there for 3 or 4 months till they brutalized us, both Lugar and myself, just to make the point. He makes this flowery thing. I make the motion to recommit this bill back to the Labor Committee with a report back forthwith as a pending business. And he turns to me real benignly, figuring I'd have to object. Now, when I told Fritz this, he said, you got to object. I said, I can't object. You know, if I object, it becomes a procedural vote, and all you guys will have to support Byrd. Well, who's going to object? I said, you are. So Byrd makes this flowery thing, praising these two young freshman senators for all that they had done and how sincere they are and in this losing cause and so forth. I mean, it was really wonderful. I'm not sitting around like this, you know, thinking, my gosh, what accolades, you know? yeah. And so he finishes and he benignly turns to me, waiting for my object, because he knew if I objected, it was over that way. All of a sudden, he hears this big, loud object from his side of the floor. His head spun around so fast, I thought he had a whiplash, honest to goodness. And Fritz objected. And Byrd started screaming. And then all of a sudden, Russell Long, who didn't want to cross over and vote, he was voting with us, but I knew we'd lose him in the end. Russell Long shot out of his chair, speaking 4,000 words in a minute, as only Russell Long could do. He was marvelous. He was really something. And said, well, this is not democracy, and then he finally said, I'm going to have to vote for cloture. At that point, Fritz said, Russell, we always knew you were going to leave. At that point, Ted Stevens, I'll never forget it, who was badly abused by our own Justice Department, who should never have gone through what he went through, who was innocent and proven to be so when the final exculpatory evidence was allowed to come out. Wonderful book written on that, by the way. Ted stood up, he said, well, Russell, if you're crossing over, I'm crossing back. He had left us on the third vote because of a huge Teamster contingency, and we knew we'd won. That's just one, but that was an important battle. Had we lost that, it would have been over. I'm telling you. This country would have been unionized against its will. And look, this is a young man who spent 10 years as a union member in the FL-CIO as a skilled tradesman. Learned the trade and worked for 10 years in the building construction trade unions. So I don't hate unions at all. But this was a power grab like you've never seen before in your life. And we couldn't have stopped it had it not been for a filibuster. And of course, there were a lot of things came from that as well. Now, I can name dozens and dozens of things like that. This country would have been gone had it not been. So the Democrats can use that too, and sometimes it's irritating. Sometimes they think, oh, well, why are they doing that? Well, I know why they're doing it. They have a right to. And frankly, it does make the Senate sit up and take notice of other people's points of view. I'd fight to my death for the filibuster, knowing how important it has been in saving the country time after time. Yeah, it's hurt us time after time, because when they have the votes, that's fine. But to be honest with you, you only need 41 votes to stop a really bad piece of legislation. Now, that's pretty hard sometimes for Republicans to get. It was really hard back then, because we had like 14 Republicans who were led by Jack Javits, who I to this day think is one of the greatest, brightest people I've ever known in the Senate, who were going to go against us, or wanted to go against us, put it that way. So don't jump too soon on that. Look through over history, and you'll find that it has been a very beneficial thing. Now, the way it's being used to call up a bill, as Harry Reid would do, immediately file cloture on a motion to proceed, or even the bill itself, and then not allow a debate at all. Yeah, that's an abuse of the system. That's not a filibuster. That's an abuse of the system. So, that was done over and over and over again, more than any other time. Now, I'm not saying you can't do that, because there are some things that are so important you might have to do that, but not on everything, but on a partisan basis. And that's what was going on, and that's undoubtedly what had you up in arms. And you know, there's an argument against improper use of a filibuster, because that was no filibuster. I could go on and on. I'm sorry. I went on and on as it was. I apologize to all of you. Yes, sir.
All right. I think Leonard's going
to. Yeah, we're going to have to.
You want to stop?
We're going to have to invoke cloture.
But you don't seem to, take into consideration is I still have the floor.
As I said before, a man who knows his procedure. Senator Hatch, thank you very much for being here, but more importantly, thank you very much for the tremendous kindness and generosity you've shown to the Federalist Society over the years and for your leadership in our country. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.